I prayed for Fred Hinney out there in 52, and he went up to the Pirates, obligation to Branch Rickey Martin. And then Bobby Braden comes in, and Bobby was a tremendous manager, played good, smart baseball, and I could play. So he said to me, "Well, you're a free shortstop." I said, "Yeah, I'm as well as a shortstop." He says, "Okay." He said, "You're going to be my shortstop the rest of the year." And I ended up playing shortstop and was an all-star. Then we win the pennant in 53. In 54, we tied for the pennant, and I was the most valuable player in the league that year. And we played against the San Diego Dodgers, and Bobby was there for the first time, and hit for the major Dodgers, and they ended up beating us the ball game for the pennant. So I am now the most valuable player, and now the Pittsburgh Pirates, Branch Rickey still owned me, and the Pittsburgh Pirates sold me to the Chicago White Sox for $35,000, and Jim Bomber, their $50,000 bonus shortstop, came over to Pittsburgh, and I went to the Chicago White Sox. That winter, I played baseball down in Havana, in that winter league that they had down there. I played with the Boyer boy, that managed the Cardinals, and everybody. There was nine American boys in the team, in major leaguers, and
Kenny Boyer,
and Frank Trader Lane was a Chicago White Sox general manager. He came down and saw me, asked me how I felt. I'd hurt my knee that year, earlier in the year, and asked me how my knee was, and they were counting. I said, "I feel fine. I'm great." I said, "I'm ready to go." Now Bucky Harris is managing Detroit, and I played for Bucky in 47 with the Yankees. And so now a trade during the winter, a trade was cooked up where Leo Cristani, myself, and Ferris Fain came from the Chicago White Sox to the Detroit Tigers. And Billy Gray, Neiman, and Droppo went to the White Sox from Detroit. So that was how I got over with Detroit from the White Sox. I never did dress in the White Sox uniform. I just was kind of over there. And I got to Detroit, and it was the same way. But he used me with the platoon
system.
And you'd sit there, you'd face a pitcher like Whitey Ford and Tommy Byrne. And then you'd sit there for another day or two, and while the right-handers were going to work, and then you'd come to me, you'd face Herb Store and a few other guys, and I'd be doing a little pinch hitting in between, and it was fantastic. The one year I hit 316, and I would say eight for 17 pinch hitting.
You don't have anything to apologize for. I looked up now your total overall major league lifetime batting average is .283. There's nothing wrong with .283. That'll get you in the Hall of Fame nowadays.
I tell you, it's amazing, Ren, when I think about in those days, if you were a shortstop and you hit under .250 or .240, you were in trouble. A shortstop. And that was the lightest hitting man in the ball club, except for a few guys like Marty Marion, who was and Lou Boudreau, who were exceptional shortstops and good hitters, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, the shortstop and second baseman, why, they were the glove men, and your outfielders, and all the other holes were filled up pretty well by solid hitters. And now I think about, I say, my God, fellows that are hitting .240 now are stars in the big leagues. And they're everyday ball players.
Yeah, that's right. And demanding, they're free agents now. Well, of your total years experience in the big leagues, is there any one event that seems to stand out? Any one experience that you remember above your others?
Well, Ren, I felt this way when you asked me before about my thoughts as a kid and as I come up to baseball in my life to get into the major league. I just being in a major league ballpark was an experience for me. Like I mentioned about walking the Yankee Stadium and going into all these ballparks and these great ballparks and playing and having had the opportunity when I was with the Yankees, I played with DiMaggio and Henrik and Yogi, and then in Pittsburgh, I was with Kiner and Westlake and Clyde McCullough and Murray Dixon, fellows like that. And I get to Detroit and with Kaline and Romek and all these Boone and Keen and all these fellows, Frank House, that were just big men. These were just a thrill to be playing with these fellas and to be a part. Everything was a thrill. I never hated going to the ballpark one day, even if I was in a slump or doing badly. I wanted to go to the ballpark.
Yeah, it was a thrill to walk in the
It was just that's the way a lot of fellas looked at it years ago.
I can imagine what it would be like for a ball player because as a spectator, the first major league ball game I ever saw was a World Series game, and I walked into Yankee Stadium at 10 o'clock in the morning. That was when the gates opened. I got my bleacher seat. And ball players came out, I think, around noon. And I remember just, I was awed by the empty Yankee Stadium. And then pretty soon, out came DiMaggio and people like that. And Ruffing was still with him. That was before you were with him. And it was Gehrig's last year. And I was just goosebumps all over just being in Yankee Stadium and seeing these ball players that I'd heard about and read about. Never imagined that I'd ever see them. Well, do you have any... You mentioned about managers. Do you have any favorite manager or any particular manager story?
Well, not necessarily a manager, but you asked me about, you know, my experience in the big leagues. And like I say, that 47 series was surely an experience. That just being in the World Series and being there in Yankee Stadium with 70,000 people there.
That's right.
And then having the opportunity. I pinch it in the third game and fly it out to left field. Started the sixth game. George McQuinn had been the renovated first baseman that year. He hit 300, over 300 for him, and he struck out six.
That was another one we neglected to mention. I knew about it. They had. It seemed like they could get the retread first baseman. There was Johnny Mize, Johnny Hopp, and George McQuinn.
They all did their job, huh?
They all did a good job.
Yeah, I think you had to, you know, you said something about you. And George McQuinn was. Jordan McQuinn was in the Yankee organization, but the guy by the name of Gehrig just displaced him. So they sold McQuinn into Brown, and had a tremendous career over there. And then he was with the Athletics just the year before, and that's when the Yankees got him over there to and shore up their position, and that's what they did. And well, anyway, I started the sixth game, and just being there, I was like a fan. He sat there in the dugout.
How could you concentrate?
Well, you concentrated pretty good. Like I say, Bucky Harris was our manager, and I'll never forget that ball game. If you remember when Bill Bevins pitched 8 2/3, no hit, no run ball, and Pete Reeser was a center fielder on opening day in Yankee Stadium for the Dodgers, and then he slipped and pulled a muscle in his leg.
Yeah,
so he would, this was Reeser that was sitting on the sidelines after the second game. And this is the game, then the same series where Giolito made his tremendous catch on DiMaggio. The only time
DiMaggio.
He ever lost, that's right, existed. Most people don't know, but that's the only time that I think George DiMaggio ever showed any emotion on the ball field. All he did was run the bases, never thrown out, catch five balls that he made look so easy. Other outfielders are diving and going for him. And here it is in the World Series, and he makes that, the Giolito makes the catch. And in that ball game that Bevins is pitching, he walked. He walked a man to first base, and then Eddie Mixes came in and ran. Eddie Mixes stole second base, and Rizzuto was quite disturbed on the call. And we were ahead, one run. Now Pete Reeser is going to pinch hit. And he had the bad leg, but that short porch in old Evans Field right there, and Pete Reeser was one of the better hitters in baseball. And Bucky Harris got right up off the bench, and here's the note. And there's two outs and a man on second base, the tying run on second base, the winning run at the plate. He's told Pete Reeser is going to hit, and Bucky got up, walked right down to the water cooler, and said, it's against all the rules of baseball to put that winning run on. He said, if this guy can hit that short porch out there, he can hit the ball out of here. Right hand pitcher, just left handed hitting again.
Yeah.
And he said, put him on. And up comes the cookie. And that first fish that took you right up in here, and we threw it right by him for a strike. You know, then he missed on one, and he ran one and one, and then he came right back up. But this time he made a mistake and got a lot over the face of him, and he hit that ball, hit that right field fence. And that right field fence had a screen up on top, yeah, about 35, 40 feet up. It was a screen, and then it came down to cement, and then down at the bottom, it slanted right back towards the infield. And that ball went up there and went by Henrik, and it hit that wall, and he started chasing the ball around. And Bill Bevins, they put in a runner then, oh, it was Mixus that ran for Pete Reeser when he had won. And Bill Bevins went to back up third base at first. And by that time, here's Henrik, and he's chasing that ball down, and that man came all the way around, and Bill was between third and home plate, and didn't know whether to go back up home or not, and just tucked the glove right in his pocket, and headed right into our third base dugout, right towards the shell. Yogi Berra ends up with the ball at home plate. No play allowed, and Yogi's running, and said, "Hey, Yogi, toss me the ball." Yogi said, "Here, take the damn thing, I don't want it." I got that ball signed by Larry Jettis, one of the most cherished moments I got.
Great, yeah.
But that was one of the things, and also in that series, you know, you can look at the record, and you're great on record, and you and your group save. But I'll tell you, now my name is not in the record book. But you know, you always have a feeling that you're going to set a record, you're going to make a record, you're going to do something different. Now, I've helped a lot of fellows that, like Johnny Sane, like Warren Spahn, Bob Feller. I helped a lot of fellows get into the world, the Hall of Fame.
Yeah,
you know.
But
I'll tell you, the 1947 series, Little Vic Lombardi started the sixth ball game, and I had rounded out sharply to second base the first time against him. Now I come up to bat the second time, and the tying run is on second base. We were behind in that ball game. And that was a ball game, if you remember, that was a game that the Giolito made the catch on at DiMaggio, and we got beat that game, went to the seventh game, and we won. Now there's a tying run is on second base, and Vic Lombardi is still in the ball game. And I'm going up the home plate. Like I said, there's 70,000, there's 4,000 standing people. That stadium held 70,000 people, there were 74,000 people at the sixth game of the 47 series. And I'm telling you, I'm ready to set a record. I'm not going to get my name in that record.
Yeah, yeah.
So all of a sudden, Albert Schotten was running the Brooklyn Ball Club, because that was the year that Leo DeRocher had gotten in trouble with the commissioner, and he had to go out and rest that summer. So Bert Schotten was running the Brooklyn Ball Club. Just as I come up the home plate, out comes Bert Schotten towards the mound. And I had a funny feeling what was going to happen. They were going to bring in a big right-handed pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And they were down the book, and he got out there to the mound, and he got down to the mound, and they give this big high sign, and I knew. So I didn't want to look at that Bucky Harris who got empty dugout.
Bucky was...
So, I'm looking all around, 70,000 people in Yankee Stadium. I think I was looking for someone from my hometown, Marilla, New York or something, but I didn't want to look down there. I waited for that pitcher to come in, and I'm going to hit against him, and I'm going to let time run. I'm going to score it. I'm going to knock it in. When you're a kid in school, you could always feel that you were in trouble, or at home. You could always feel the teacher looking you right in the back. And I could feel it. So I finally looked over. And here's the big right-hander warming up. And I looked over the dugout. And here's Bucky going like this. So what can I do? So
yeah.
He waving me towards him. So I go back over. And Bucky says, "Jack," he says, "hey, we got a right-hand pitcher out there now." He says, "I think I'm going to let a guy pitch. I'm going to let Brown pitch it for you." I said, "Now, Bucky, I can hit this guy." He says, "I know you can, probably, Jack." He says, "But I got a guy I think that's qualified to hit against him, too. And it's Dr. Bobby Brown." See?
Not that anyone's
talking. No, like I said, you can look in the record. Well, anyway, Bobby pitched it for me. And at that time, he set a World Series for pinch hitting, and he drove in that tying run there. So I looked at it this way. Now, you look in the books, my name is not there. But now, if I hadn't started that sixth ball game, then he couldn't have pinch hit for me to set a World Series record. So my name is not there, but I'm responsible for a World Series record.
You got an assist.
That's right. Also, there's one other thing. When I was at the Pirates, Harry the Capper King, we're playing the Cardinals. This is the year the Cardinals and the Dodgers are battling. Nip and tuck. In fact, that year they had the playoff. But the ball game is tied. We're in Forbes Field. The bases are loaded. There's one out. in the bottom of the ninth inning. They're ahead of us 6-3. And they bring in Harry the Catholic team to relieve. I'm in the bullpen. They call me in to pinch hit. Now, this is late in the season, and every game, you know, is so important. We're going nowhere, but we are going to decide to a certain extent what happens. Well, anyway, I pinch hit. Hank Shinn was on first base, and I forget who was on the other two bases now. And Harry the Cat threw me a curveball. Now, in Ford's Field, they had ripped the Greenberg Gardens, and Bertiner and Hank Greenberg, and they still had it up. It was still a pretty good shot, but it was a low cyclone fence, probably about a 10-foot fence. And the bullpen was in left center field, that's right there by the field. And the Mutual was playing the outfield, and Chuck Deering was also playing center field for the Cardinals. And he threw me a curveball down in the way, and I reached out, and when I hit it, I knew I hit the ball good. And with one out, why, the runners had started to come back to tag up. Mm-hmm. After they cut, if they catch the ball, then they're going to advance one base and put the tying run on second base and score our fourth run from third base. Well, anyway, Hank Shanks was coming back towards first base. I didn't notice anything about Hank Shanks coming back to tag up, but at the same time, cheering from center field is running towards the fence. Mutual from left field is running towards the fence. And now they're converging on the fence and the ball, and all of a sudden they hit the wall. No one knows where the ball is. Shanks now had turned. I, at that precise moment, up on top of Ford Field, a photographer had taken a shot, and this picture came out in the ball in the paper the following day. But anyway, they finally held the ball up in the bullpen. It was a grand slam pinch hit, grand slam home run that beat the Cardinals the ball game. The next day in the paper comes a picture out of the whole field. It showed the outfielder hitting the fence and everything else, and it showed Hank Shanks here coming back to tag up, and I had passed him, and I was halfway to second base when that photograph was taken. And actually, when you pass a runner on the base picture, heck yeah, but no one was watching any part of that play. They were all trying, the umpires were trying to see if the ball had gone over the fence or where the ball was, but it was just ironic but that was a big thrill because it helped knock them out of contention, not contention, but you know, one of the
things. Yeah. It happened just recently, matter of fact, I believe it was last year, I can't recall, but a runner passed another runner. I don't recall who it was, but it was well written. I think it was Pittsburgh.
Yes, it was.
Cash, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that's right. Now, there's one other thing. I don't know if you saw the ball game yesterday.
No.
You can see here what happened yesterday?
Oh, yeah.
Billy Martin with the
pine
tar
on the back?
Right. Now, yeah. 1949 with the Yankees. Connie Mack is still running the Philadelphia Athletics. Alex Kelliher is one of their pitchers, a left-handed pitcher. I'm with the Yankees, and I had a bat that I used to take and put linseed oil into it, and then sear it over and coat it with rosin and bake it on, and then bone it down to make the surface hard. Mm-hmm. It was legal, except that in those days, the same rule applied then that applies now. You can't have any foreign substance on your bat from the trademark on up to the end of the bat. It's got to be all the same color. You can't have any foreign substance on it or anything like that. Like I say, and when you burn that rosin, you have to take alcohol, put it on a bunch of cotton, and you take and heat the bat. You set that on fire and you heat the bat, and then you take your rosin bag and pat it onto, and then you take it and you rub it in and it hardened that wood down. You used to get a lot of checks in that in your bat because of the wood, the imprint of the seam of the ball, and it would tend it to check. This hardened it up so it wouldn't check on the bottom. But anyway, I had hit a home run against Alex Kelliher. And the first time up, Alec came up to bat the next time, and Connie's sitting in the dugout with that scorecard that he used to have. And he says, Mr. Umpire, and he called the umpire over.
Because he couldn't go on the field and swing and close.
Yeah, that's true. But he called him over, and the umpire, I forget who the umpire was now, whether it was C-Pig Summers or who it was. But anyway, he came back over and says to me, you can't use that bat. I said, what do you mean? I used it last time. He says, you used it last time, but that's what Mr. Mack, he doesn't want you to use it this time again, he said, because that bat is discolored from the trademark on up, he says, and he said that he doesn't want you to use it, and according to the rules, I can't allow you to use it, so I had to get rid of my bat. That's why it was so interesting yesterday when George Brett came up and hit the home run.
Yeah.
Now that really marked the shoe.
That's right.
And he called it on him right off the bat.
That's
and
right. He would have said he would never have mentioned it if he'd have grounded out and never been. He's been waiting all year for the critical thing. Billy Martin is sharp, and I don't care what you say. Billy Martin never takes his eye off that game. He knows what's going on.
He's a shrewd manager, and when that happened, and I could see it coming, it instantly came back in my mind about Connie Mack sitting there and seeing, and here's another thing that had happened to me, you know, that I felt pretty good about, that a man is going to call a shot like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when I saw Billy do that, and it's the first time Billy's kept the shoe with an umpire because he knew he had him dead to right. And
Billy was smart. See, he didn't object before Brett batted.
Right.
See?
Yeah.
And if he'd have done nothing, he'd been waiting, and may never come this year. But he was waiting for it, and that was the moment.
Yeah. And there was just one other thing that happened to me in the big leagues, too. I had a lot of wonderful things happen to me, but I mean, not much notoriety. But
yeah,
a home run hurt St. Louis that year, and they hit it off a pinch hit home run off Harry the Catholic King. You know, I felt quite happy about it. Now, we're in Detroit. And I had doubled, and we're playing the Yankees. Mantle's playing the center field. Steve Gomek is pitching for Detroit, and Steve could do a pretty good job on Mantle. He'd start him off here and just go right up the ladder and in tighter all the time, and Mantle would chase it. He had just struck Mantle out for the third straight time in the ball game. And Mantle, he was the last out of the inning. Mickey is out in the center field, and he's still hitting. He's not ready for the defense yet. I got up and I doubled. I'm on second base and nobody out, and the next hitter is Ray Boone. Ray hits a long shot to right center field. That's a lot of, there's about 438 feet that you go in Tiger Stadium. And he went over and caught the ball, figuring, man, I was 34, 35 years old at the time, so he's probably figuring, well, the old man's only going to go to third base, you know. So he gave it that lollygag, the throw back into the infield.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy Hitchcock is a third base coach. And all I see is Billy doing like this. So I thought, well, Mantle must have slipped or the ball dropped out of his glove. I saw him catch the ball, and that's when I tagged up, and that's when I left. And I just kept right on going, all the way from second base into home plate on Ray Boone's 430-foot fly ball.
Fly ball out, yeah.
And I said, you know, I wonder what had happened. And this is what had happened. He was still striking out that third time against Gomek, and he just gave it the mediocre lie back in. And I wasn't the slowest man in the world either, and I come all the way. Now Billy Bruton is playing center field for the Detroit Tigers. He's on second base. Now, Billy Bruton was a speed jade. He was a fast runner. In fact, he scored 13 times when Gene Mock and he played together in the minor leagues, and Gene Mock hit behind Billy Bruton, and he scored from first base on the hit and run on base hits by Mock 13 times in 1 year from first base on the hit and run. With Mock in bed. Well, anyway, he's on second base, and the same thing goes up. Here is the man tagging up on second base, and he tagged up on second base and came all the way in to score. And it's just the first time they'd ever seen anything like that, a man scoring a sacrifice fly from second base. And Watson Spolster, the sports writer, still there in Detroit, he said, we had an old man by the name of Jack Phillips that did that. He said back years ago.
Do you know that it's ever been done before or since?
I had never.
It'd make a great trivia question.
It would.
And I have a trivia book, and I like to fool around with trivia. And some of these guys are great. I'll bet you if I were to ask that at one of our Sabre meetings, somebody would come up with the answer and say, yes, Jack Phillips.
Well, I'll tell you, Billy Bruton, I could say, Billy Bruton did it about 10 years or more. I don't know how much longer it was after that I had done it. See, this was in 50, this was in 50, 56, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
And I had never heard of it. Now, you fellas are doing a tremendous job. You know, this trivia that they have is amazing, and they're getting a lot of interest in it and finding out a lot of things about the game that before, now is a big interest, and before you just took it for granted, just like you're playing the game of baseball. You
know. The thing is now, we're recording it.
Yeah.
See, and do you realize that Sabre members, through their efforts, that most of the Negro League's records now have been made? You know, the records just weren't kept.
Yeah.
And through newspaper accounts and that sort of thing, they have done a great job in restoring or actually compiling for the first time. It was through our efforts, Sabre Man Perhaps you read this account. There was some argument about the batting title in 1910, Cobb and Lajoie.
Mm-hmm.
And Cobb got the batting title by 2 percentage points. And through an effort of one of our members who was doing some other research, found a couple of hits that Lajoie made that were never recorded. And so Lajoie is recognized by authorities as the batting champion in 1910, but Bowie Kuhn will not allow the records to be changed because he feels that it's so long and so much time has passed that why bother? Mm-hmm. But you know, if a man were sent to prison for a crime that he never did, and he spent several years there and they found out evidence that conclusively proved that he was innocent, would they say, well, let's just leave him in there? So we feel that it should be. Well, before the tape runs out, a couple other questions I want to ask you, Jack, and then I let you go. Have you seen any games on artificial surface, and how do you feel about artificial surface? And then just a word about today's salaries as compared to the salaries when you were playing.
Yeah, I've gone up to Montreal quite a bit since then, and I like their club, and I have some friends on the club, and I've seen them play on that artificial surface. I've seen on TV, but of course you got to be in the ballpark that were to see the surface and then to see the reaction. On TV, it's tough to tell, and you don't. It's just a common matter of fact type of thing now. But on that surface, other than the seam, the way they have it around the bases where you could get a footprint years ago. You had the grass, you could get a bad bounce, you could get a heel imprint. You had your hands today had to be amazingly quick, just like they had 2 years ago. You had to compensate for that little bad hop that you would get off of the natural turf. And it would be kicked up by the runner. This surface here, boy, when those balls hit, it may take off. Now how it's going to be on the players' field. Their legs and things like that.
I think that somebody is going to compile some statistics, and it's about due now, maybe in a few years. You hear announcers say, well, that was an artificial surface hit. That moves, it goes boom, it's through there. There's no way, I mean, it'll get between the third baseman and the shortstop, I mean, and neither way you'll see them cross, and it gets between them. Whereas you just have a feeling that a couple of bounces on grass, one of them would have had it, see?
Well, a possibility. No. Back when St. Louis Cardinals and the St. Louis Browns were in the same ballpark, they never got a chance to work in that ball field because one was always a home team right there.
Yeah.
And the Cardinals had a bunch of fellows that would slap the ball and bounce on like it was on concrete because they just couldn't, and there was tufts of grass. That infield was not the best surface to play on because they had been used so much. And that's what they would hit on top of the ball, and the ball would hit, and every time that ball hit that infield, it picked up speed as it was going through the infield. Now on this surface here, it's so hard down underneath that it goes right on through. But I'll say this though, a natural grass, with a little moisture in that grass, and nice grass, an outfielder's throw would take, and you could put life in that ball. If you threw that ball straight overhand with the spin coming right straight back against you, it's a good overhand throw, that ball would hit the grass and take off because it was thinner and slick.
Mm-hmm.
If it was dry and tucked up, by then it would slow the ball down, whereas this natural surface, I mean this artificial turf that they have, with the what's underneath it, it's quick. And the fellas have that, but they don't get the bad bounces. They don't play much deeper than they used to play when you cut the skin back. Now they've still got the infield outline because of the speed of the runners and the speed of the ball. Even if they're hit that much harder, then they're going to have trouble throwing them out at first base because they're playing back too fast or too far. I don't know, but I would say that I enjoy playing it on natural turf. The only thing I see is the bunny, and you see a lot of guys. They just don't play the bunt anymore. Let's face it.
No, and since you mentioned that, it disturbs me, and I've seen some games recently when, next to pitching, a pitcher, to me, ought to be able to bump. And when I see, he was holding his bat in foul territory trying to bunt the other day, and it's just an automatic out. And in the old days, there were fellows who took pride in their pitching. The Yankees used Red Ruffing as a pinch hitter quite often. Don Newcomb, as late as that, it took pride in his hitting. And, of course, Rick Farrell, and who was the catcher and who was the pitcher? It was one of the Farrells.
Yeah, Wes was the
catcher. Okay, Rick Farrell. Mm-hmm. And there were many, many pitchers. And Dizzy Dean, nobody loved to have his hits more than Dizzy. And he was up there, and he dug in, and he loved to hit. But it just, I don't know, they just don't teach it anymore.
Well, man, you know, this is a statistic, too, and I tell you, the reason that guys like Lemon were winning 20 games a year and got to stay in a ball game because they could hit the ball and they could bunt the ball. If a pitcher could bunt the ball, and you'd sacrifice with him every time because then let that next guy drive in that run. Mm-hmm. And now they don't practice bunting. They don't practice a lot of things that are the basics of baseball. And now they're no longer telling me that you can't learn how to bunt on an artificial surface. What's the difference? Rizzuto used to take, and Sterna used to take a half a swing at the ball and still drag the ball down third base, and that third baseman would be playing in to field the ball.
Yeah.
And still beat it out. Right? And then the other question I asked you was about the salaries. Well, I tell you, years ago you used to say, well, they play the game because you love the game, that's why you played it.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, that's about what it was, because I never made big money in the big leagues. I was included in that 47 World Series, and I got some money, and that is nothing now compared to what they have in the big leagues, you know, but then their playoffs and then the World Series. And $6,400 was a big World Series full share, would depend on the parts you played in the first four games, is why you got credit for, you know, now with the TV money and everything else like that going into it. But anyway, I believe that a player should be picked. But now it's the other way around. At one time, the general manager and the owners had you, and they'd sign their stars first, and then the mediocre ball player, the part-time ball player, they'd give you something. If you liked it, okay. If you didn't, lump it, and they could re-sign you for the same money that you had signed for the year before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now with the change in your free agent status and all these things, and now with all these fellows with agents, everybody's got an agent. Years ago, you battled head-to-head. Sometimes your wife should let her negotiate for you, but you still got that contract back, and then they would give you anyway, with the money out today, it's amazing how these fellows, and without the lack of minor league, I've seen these fellows getting paid the money that they're playing for. You got to get it in a hurry because your major league life is not there. Now you'll have to be a four-year man to be a vested member in their pension plan.
Yeah.
Years ago, it was a five-year man, 172 days a year, to be a vested member in their plan. And now with the TV money and that. And on top of that, now these players go in and their agents say, well, this is what we want. And now they can say, if you don't want to pay me that, now, if you can sign me this year, I got one more year to go on. I'm a free agent next year. So you better get me now and pay me a lot of money, or next year I'm going to try the free agent market.
Sure.
Or we'll negotiate for that 1 year and get an arbitrator. And even that arbitration, I think they're overboard. What do you expect? No wonder there's no minor league, because the major league club puts the bills for all their minor league players, all their salaries, and they lose money there. It used to cost the Yankees $150,000 a year to have a ball club in Newark. But they got their players out. Yeah. Now, why build your club around a fellow that's going to say to you, I'm going to leave you next year unless you pay me this much money? You get the money that is being spent by these fellas, and now they pay out their free agency and they leave you. And now here you're at nucleus and your team is gone.
Yeah.
And you got to do all these things. I think that they should get a fair amount of money, but some of these things that they're asking, $1 million. Now you take this boy Parker from Pittsburgh. He's going to be being paid in the year 2002. He will long be gone out of baseball by then, and he's still going to be getting paid then. It used to be in baseball.
Winfield is the same way,
This is true, but at the same time, you used to get paid the following year for what you did the year before. Now these guys are going to get paid before they even do it, and they're not doing it.
Yeah. Well, I haven't run anything on this, but from my own memory, these free agents who signed for multi-bucks, as far as I know, only one man has done better after he signed than before he signed. And he only did it for 1 year. Pete Rose, I think, had a little better year after he signed with Philadelphia, but no other free agent who signed for multi-bucks has done better since he signed than he did before he signed. They've gone downhill. They don't have to put out. They really don't have to worry.
It's a matter of effort. They're changing clubs. And when you change from one club to another club, depending on the club you're going to, now you're running into a different manager, you're running into different people that you're playing with.
A different league, too.
And now these guys, years ago, you used to get to the ballpark quick and put your uniform on, because if you didn't, somebody else would have it on, or you were gone down to the minor leagues. When you had 52 professional leagues, that was a lot of places. Fellas made a career out of playing. And when I managed in the Philadelphia organization, I was turning loose boys if there was a place for them to play. After a year or two, if they didn't show that much progress, well, then they would get rid of them and bring in another boy and try him for a year or two. And then you're wiping kids out of a profession when they're 19, 20, 21 years old, but they got full time to start another career somewhere else.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Years ago, when you had a lot of offers, fellas would play double A ball and even triple A ball as a career.
Yeah,
until they
10 or 15 years.
Play.
Right. Yeah.
And now you're forced out of it, and the salary, so I can see these fellas trying to get their salaries up as high. But I just don't like the idea of a guy handling a man and making millions of dollars off a player by negotiating for it.
Yeah. Let's get this in before we run out of time. Now you're the baseball coach at Clarkson. Is it difficult for Clarkson players to attract scouts? The reason being that it's a small college and not as widely known as some of the big baseball factories like Arizona and Southern Cal and North Carolina and that sort of thing.
Well, the only thing is that when a scout goes up and sees that league where Arizona's in, or Miami, Florida, or wherever they're going, Texas, they see a caliber of ball that is excluding our boys here at Clarkson and some in these other schools that we play here. Education is the primary thing. It is to a certain degree for these other people that are playing in Arizona State and things like that, maybe physical education, whatever degree that they're working for. But there's a concentrated, there are a better, higher caliber class ball player playing there because they can give them grant and aid. Here at Clarkson, we don't give them, the only thing I can help a boy with is financial aid is if he's an excellent student. And we have some good ball players that are excellent students. But a majority of ball players that want to go or try to go professional will go to a school like Ithaca. We'll go to a school like Des Moines, where they do give athletic grant and aids at Des Moines and these other Arizona, and they will get an opportunity to play more games. See, back east here, when they had the NCAA allowed you to play ball, so we had a fall season here, that went for our overall spring and fall. When they knocked that out, then they took about 20 to 25 games away from the eastern schools that played ball.
Mm-hmm.
And now all we can do, our season starts here in the spring on April 12th, we're done by May 1st, and I'll play 24 games, all 7-inning doubleheaders.
Mm-hmm.
And our boys here, if they've got an exam to make, or if they've got a test or a paper or a thesis or anything to do, then if they're on the road that day, then they have to stay here and get their exam done, whatever. I did have a boy in 1970 by the name of Gary Jungi, who pitched for the Cubs for 3 years.
And well, that was my next question. Any gone into pro ball, and if so, and he made it to the big leagues?
Well, Gary Jungi was just a Cubs in spring training for 3 years. They send him out, and they bring him back. So finally, he gave it up, but he spent 3 years in the Cubs roster and would be there for a month or two or three, and then be optioned back down. And he's the only boy. I have had some other boys that did have a talent. And the scouts here do see us play, because we play Ithaca. When they hear every scout now, if they're scouting for the system, the organized ball, they will see, and they got to have a card on every kid, because if some kid comes out of a high school or a college and some team signs him as a free agent instead of through the draft, then somebody is doing their job. So they have a card on every kid that is playing baseball in any college. But if they hear it, and now they will concentrate on the kid that shows, like, kids here, if they had the time to devote to baseball, and would take the my experience and my coaching, and they could devote it, I've had some ball players that would have been major leaguers.
Mm-hmm.
But they come here for an education, and they don't have time to, I've had kids come to me and spit out the bit, what I call spitting out the bit. They say, Coach, I can't keep up my work, my school work, and play baseball at the same time.
being a farmer, yeah. I know what spitting out the pit is.
So I say to the boy, okay, so the emphasis on baseball, yes, we have pride here. We wear the Yankee pinstripes too. We have a nice major league uniform. We do everything first class, the same as they do in a lot of the other colleges like Arizona, except we don't have the programs they got. But our boys are and have had some experience and have gone into pro ball, but not like these here Mills that you're speaking about.
Well, did this young fellow you mentioned him who went with the Cubs, did he ever get into a Cub lineup? Did you know in the major?
Oh yes, oh yes.
Oh, I see.
Well, he pitched there. He was with the Cubs spring training 3 years. He was the club for a month or two, or then they sent him down to the Texas League, and he was starting and he was relieving. He never could get his feet set. He was at the same time as this Russo boy. Russo is the one that the Yankees are given a chance to pitch his way.
He's down in the minors now.
Yeah. And he was in the organization. It was between him and Russo every year, whether he would be there or Russo would be there to a certain extent. Russo became established, and every year the kid would go to spring training and say, I got a chance to make it this year, coach. And then, well, first thing you know, he'd be there for a month and come cut down date, and bang, down he would go again into the minor leagues, to high minor. And this is the way baseball was run years ago. And like I say, with the minor leagues gone now, and with these fellas, now you wipe a boy out in a year or two, and if they had a place to play, their desire is there. I turn kids loose and I know that we're going to be triple-A ball players anyway. And where does a ball player come from? And you know that. Here's little northern New York. Here's Clarkson College. Two of us, Frankie Shea played for Hank Hodge, and I played for Hank Hodge. And we're both in the 47 Yankees at one time. Johnny Padres come up here from Mineville, New York, around here.
Witherby, the record show.
Witherby?
Witherby is where he was born, I don't know.
Well, Mineville is not so far around there. And you have boys from New York State that, and this, even with our season the way it is now, we have indoor cages, we can, but they don't have the time to go here.
No.
But we play the game, we play it out the way I feel that it should be played.
So I got a pitch on television the night before last from Niagara Falls.
That's right.
Well, can't think of his name now.
Manning is from Niagara Falls, the center fielder. There's a lot of boys.
And a pretty good pitcher come from that area.
Barber,
didn't he?
So Warren Spahn from Buffalo.
Yeah.
Fellas like that. And they've just played a lot of baseball. The systems are different. And now you go to a big league locker room, and my God, it's amazing. It's like being in a room in your house. TV, there's a luncheon table set there.
Hair dryers.
To me, I enjoy going into the clubhouse and seeing some of my old friends and their coaches, and they look at me and it wasn't like this when we played, was it? I said, no. And I said, is it much better? They say, well, as far as living every day, it's great. But as far as what it adds to baseball, nothing.
Are you still in contact with any of your old teammates and old friends?
Steve Roser, Emerson Roser, he used to run a restaurant down here, and we used to eat there all the time down in Utica when we went down there on a road trip. I still in contact with Frankie Shea now and then, who's over at Nautica, up in the recreation department over there. I go to Montreal, and I saw Yogi Berra in New York City. I went back down to the stadium a couple years ago after it renovated. The first time I'd been back since Detroit, when I was with Detroit, and saw Yogi. And I see him down in spring training. If I go down there, I see a lot of the old timers. And it makes me feel good. Like Monty Basgell, I was with him on the Pirates. He's coaching for LA now. Dallas Green, he's running Chicago. Pat Corrales caught for me. Who was just fired by Philadelphia.
Yeah, in first place.
He caught for me in 1963 down in Chattanooga.
Is that right?
I could say a lot of people I played with and went to school with are announcers and things like that. And it makes me feel pretty good for having, I played Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
I was on a lot of winners in minor league baseball, and I take pride in that because in '43, my first year, we ended up in the playoffs with Yogi. And in 1946, I went north, and we ended up in the playoffs in 46 with the Newark Bears. In 1947, I went to Lucky with the Yankees World Series. In 1949, I went to the Yankees, and I sold over to Pittsburgh, and that was the year they won the series. In 1952, I went to Los Angeles, and I mean Hollywood Stars, we were at a Pennant McCoskey. In 53, we were in the Pennant McCoskey. In 54, we tied for the Pennant McCoskey. 1955, came back to big leagues. 1950, the latter part of 57, I go out to San Francisco. We win the Pennant in 57, in the McCoskey again. 1959, I'm with Buffalo, and we win the pennant in Buffalo and go into the playoffs and lose to Darren Johnson, hit three home runs in the playoffs. But I mean, I was on a lot of winners in the training game, and being in, and I run across people. I go